Peterson's The Cage was running on a large screen behind the lectern. A number of shots of undergraduates with their heads on their desks, reading their mail, making origami animals, picking at their faces with blank intensity, established that the climactic lecture wasn't coming off as all that climactic to the audience within the film. "We thus become, in the absence of death, as teleologic end, ourselves desiccated, deprived of some essential fluid, aridly cerebral, abstract, conceptual, little more than hallucinations of God," the academic read in a deadly drone, his eyes never leaving his lectern's text. The art cartridge critics and scholars who point to the frequent presence of audiences inside himself's films and argue that the fact that the audiences are always either dumb and unappreciative or the victims of some grisly entertainment mishap betrays more than a little hostility on the part of an auteur pegged as technically gifted but narratively dull and plotless and static and not entertaining enough. These academics' arguments seem sound as far as they go, but they do not explain the incredible pathos of Paul Anthony Heaven reading his lecture to a crowd of dead-eyed kids, picking at themselves and drawing vacant airplane and genitalia doodles on their college rule notepads, reading stupefyingly turgid-sounding shit.
366.
"For while Kleinemann and Tessera strive to revive or revise the dead ancestor, and while kenosis and demonization act to repress consciousness and memory of the dead ancestor, it is, finally, artistic ascesis, which represents the contest proper, the battle to the death with the loved dead." In a monotone as narcotizing as a voice from the grave, and yet all the time, weeping, Paul Anthony Heaven, as an upward hall full of kids all scan their mail, the film teacher not sobbing or wiping his nose on his tweed sleeve, but silently weeping, very steadily, so that tears run down Heaven's gaunt face and gather on his underslung chin and fall from view, glistening slightly, below the lectern's frame of sight. Then this, too, began to seem familiar. He hadn't in the beginning burgled, Gately, as a full-time drug addict, though he did sometimes promote small valuables from the apartments of the strung-out nurses he X'd and copped samples from. After the bailout from school, Gately worked full-time, for a time, for a North Shore bookmaker, a guy that also owned several titty clubs down Route 1 in Saugus, Whitey Sorkin, that had sort of casually befriended him when Gately was still playing high-profile ball. His professional association with Whitey Sorkin continued part-time even after Gately discovered his real B&E vocation, though he tended more and more toward less taxing, non-violent crime. But from age like 18 to 23, Gately and the predominant Gene Fackelman, a towering, slope-shouldered, wide-hipped, prematurely pot-bellied, oddly priapistic and congenitally high-strung, delauded addict with a walrusy mustache that seemed to have a nervous life of its own, these two served as like Whitey Sorkin's operatives in the field, taking bets and phoning them into Saugus, delivering winnings and collecting debts. It was never clear to Gately why Whitey Sorkin was called Whitey, because he spent a huge amount of time under ultraviolet lamps as part of an esoteric cluster headache treatment regimen, and so was the constant shiny color of a sort of like dark soap, with almost the same color and coin-of-the-realm classic profile, as the cheery young Pakistani MD who told Gately at Our Lady of Solace Hospital in Beverly how terribly suddy he was, that Mrs. G's cirrhosis and cirrhotic stroke had left her at roughly the neurologic level of a Brussels sprout, and then given him public transportation directions to the Point Shirley LTI. Eugene Fax Fackelman, who dropped out of the Lynn, Massachusetts educational system at like 10, had met Whitey Sorkin through the same eczematic, gamble-happy pharmacist's assistant Gately had first met Sorkin through. Gailey was now no longer called Bimmy or Doshka. He was Don now, nicknameless. Sometimes Donnie. Sorkin referred to Gately and Fackelman as his twin towers. They were, more or less, Sorkin's paid muscle, except not in any sort of way important crime figures' paid muscle is portrayed in popular entertainment. They didn't stand impassively flanking Sorkin at crime figure meetings, or light his cigar, or call him boss or anything. They weren't his bodyguards. In fact, they weren't physically around him that much. They usually dealt with Sorkin and his Saugus office and secretary via beepers and cellular phones.
367.
And while they did collect debts for Sorkin, including bad debts, especially Gately, it's not like Gately went around breaking debtors' kneecaps. Even the threat of coercive violence was pretty rare. Partly, Gately and Fackelman's sheer size was enough to keep delinquencies from getting out of hand, and partly, it was that everybody involved usually knew each other. Sorkin, his betters and debtors, Gately and Fackelman, other drug addicts, who sometimes bet, or more often dealt with Gately and Fackelman for guys that did, even the North Shore finest's vice guys, many of whom also sometimes bet with Sorkin, because he gave the finest special civil servant reductions on Vigorish. It was all like this community. Usually Gately's job on bad debts or delinquent vig was to go around to the debtor, at whatever bar the guy watched satellite sports at, and just inform him that the debt was threatening to get out of hand, making the debt itself seem like the delinquent party, and that Whitey was concerned about it, and work out some arrangement or payment plan with the guy. Then the young Gately'd go into the bar's head and cell phone Sorkin and get his okay on whatever arrangement they'd worked out. Gately was laid back and affable, and never had a hard word for anybody, hardly. Nor did Whitey Sorkin. A lot of his betters were old and steady customers, and lines of credit went with the territory. Most of the rare debt trouble that called for size and coercion involved guys with a gambling problem. Kind of pathetic, furtive guys addicted to the rush of the bet who got themselves in a hole and then tried suicidally to bet their way out of the hole, and who'd bet with several bookies at once, and who'd lie and agree to payment arrangements they had no intention of sticking to, suicidally betting they could keep all their debts in the air until they could square themselves with the major long shot score they were always sure was around the corner. These types were painful because usually Gately knew the debtors, and they'd exploit his knowing them and beg and weep and tug at both Gately's and Whitey Sorkin's heartstrings with tales of loved ones and wasting illnesses. They'd sit there and look into Gately's eyes and lie and believe their own lies, and Gately would have to call in the debtors' lies and sob stories and get Sorkin's explicit decision on if to believe them and what to do. These types were Gately's first exposure to the concept of real addiction and what it can turn someone into. He hadn't yet connected the concept to drugs, really, except cokeheads and hardcore needle jockeys, who at that point all seemed to him just as furtive and pathetic as the gambling addicts in their own way. These sob story, one more chance types were also the types that put Whitey Sorkin through hell in terms of emotionally, causing Whitey cluster headaches and terrible craniofacial neuralgia. And at a certain point, Sorkin used to start adding to the delinquent skeet, the vig, and the interest, extra charges for his own required intake of Kaffergott spansels,
368,
and UV light, and visits to Enfield, Massachusetts, National Craniofacial Pain Foundation. The use of Gately and Fackelman's rump-roast-sized fists in actual hands-on coercion got called for only when a compulsive debtor's lies and hole got serious enough that Sorkin became willing to forego the guy's patronage in the future. At this sort of point, Whitey Sorkin's business objective became to somehow induce the addicted debtor to cover his debts to Sorkin before the debtor covered his debts to any of the other books he was into, which meant for Sorkin that he had to vividly demonstrate to the debtor that Sorkin's was the least pleasant hole to be in, and the most important one to get out of. Enter the Twin Towers. The violence was to be tightly controlled and gradually progressive, in, like, stages. The first round of incentivizing hose work, a light beating, maybe a broken digit or two, usually fell to Gene Fackelman, not only because he was the naturally crueler of the Twin Towers and rather liked putting a digit in a car door, but also because he had a controlled restraint Gately lacked. Sorkin found that once Gately got started in physically on somebody, it was like something ferocious and uncontrolled on a slope inside the big kid got dislodged and started to roll on its own, and sometimes Gately wouldn't be able to stop himself before the debtor was reduced to a condition where he wasn't even going to be able to raise his head, much less funds, at which point not only did Sorkin have to write off the debt, but the big kid Donnie'd get so guilty and remorseful he'd triple his drug intake and be no use to fucking nobody for a week. Sorkin learned how to use his towers to maximize their strengths. Fackelman got the first round light work for coercive collections, but Gailey was better than Fax at negotiating arrangements with guys, so it never had to come to violence. And there were certain harder cases, cases that laid Sorkin out in bed with craniofacial stress for days at a time, because they were hard case addicts that were either so far gone or so deep in so many holes that Fackelman's like cruelty didn't resolve the situation. At an extreme point with some of these cases, Sorkin got to a point where he was willing to forego not only the debtor's future patronage, but also the remittance due. At a certain point, the goal was to minimize future other hard cases by making it clear that W. Sorkin was one book you couldn't just flagrantly stay in the hole with and lie to for month after month without having your map seriously fucking reconfigured. Here again, in this type case, Gately's internal out-of-control slope of ferocity was superior to Fackelman's easy but ultimately shallow sadism.
369.
W. Sorkin, like most psychosomatic-level neurotics, was spiteful to his enemies and overgenerous to his friends. Gately and Fackelman each received 5% vig on the 10% vigorish Sorkin took on every bet. And Sorkin made over $200,000 worth of book all over the North Shore on a week's pro ball alone, which for most diplomaless young Americans, 1,000 plus per premillennial week, would have been a very handsome living. But for the Twin Towers' rigid physical scheduling of narcotics needs, it was not even 60% enough weekly. Gailey and Fackelman moonlighted, and for a while, separately. Fackelman sidelined with IDs and creative personal checking, Gailey working freelance security for large card games and small drug deliveries. But even before they were a real crew, they copped as a unit, as in together, plus once in a moon, with poor old V. Nucci, for whom Gailey also occasionally held the rope on late-night Osco and Rite Aid skylight missions, his entree to formal burglary proper. The fact that Gately was devoted to Percocets and Bam-Bams, and Fackelman to Dilaudid, allowed them a high level of trust with each other's stashes. Gately would do blues, which had to be injected, only when no oral narcs were to be got, and he was face-to-face with early withdrawal. Gately feared and despised needles, and was terrified of the virus, which in those days was laying out needle jockeys left and right. Fackelman would cook up for Gately and tie him off, and let Gately watch closely as he took the plastic wrap off a mint new syringe and needle cartridge Fackelman could get with a fake Medicaid Illiton ID for diabetes mellitus.
370.
The worst thing about Dilaudid for Gately was that the hydromorphone's transit across the blood-brain barrier created a terrible, five-second mnemonic hallucination, where he was a gargantuan toddler in an extra, extra-large Fisher-Price crib, in a sandy field, under a storm-cloudy sky that bulged and receded like a big gray lung. Fackelman would loosen the belt and stand back and watch Gately's eyes roll up as he broke a malarial sweat and stared up at the delusion's respiritic sky, while his huge hands throttled the air in front of him, just like a toddler shakes at the bars of his crib. Then after 5 or so seconds, the Dilaudid would cross over and kick, and the sky stopped breathing and turned blue. A Dilaudid nod made Gately mute and sodden for 3 hours. Besides the maddening itch behind the eyes, Fackelman didn't like oral narcotics because, he said, they gave him terrible sugar cravings that his huge, soft, slumped weight wouldn't tolerate indulging. Not exactly the swiftest ship in Her Majesty's fleet in terms of, like, upstairs. Fackelman was resistant to Gately's pointing out that Delauded also gave the fax man terrible sugar cravings, as did actually just about everything. The plain truth was that Fackelman just really liked Delauded. Then good old Trent Kike got the administrative shoe from Salem State, who informed him he'd never study in the industry again, and Gately brought Kite into the crew. And Kite threw together some old-time Quivadas for a small crew-warming party, and Fackelman introduced Kite to pharmaceutical-grade Delauded. And Kite found a new friend for life, he said. And Kite and Fackelman swiftly fell into the ID credit history and furnished luxury apartment scam, in which, by this time, Gately involved himself pretty much only as a hobby, preferring bold nighttime merchandise promotion to fraud, which fraud tended to involve meeting the people you stole from, which Gately found slimy and kind of awkward. Gately lay in the trauma ward in terrific infected pain, trying to abide between cravings for relief, by remembering a blinding white afternoon just after Xmas when Fackelman and Kite were off disposing of some of a furnished apartment's furnishings, and Gately was killing time in the apartment, laminating some false Massachusetts driver's licenses, rush-ordered by rich Phillips Andover Academy kids for
371.
What turned out to be the last New Year's Eve of unsubsidized time. He'd been standing at an ironing board in the, by now, pretty much unfurnished apartment, ironing laminates onto the fake licenses, watching good old Boston U play Clemson in the Kennel Ration Magnavox Kemper Insurance Forsythia Bowl on a cumbersome first-generation Interlace HDV hanging on the bare wall. The high-def you were always now the last luxury furnishing to be fenced. The winter daylight through the penthouse windows was dazzling and fell across the viewer's big flat screen and made the players look bleached and ghostly. Through the windows off in the distance was the Atlantic O, gray and dull with salt. The BU punter was a hometown Boston kid, the announcers kept inserting, as a walk-on and an inspirational story that had never played a major sport until college, and now was already one of the finest punt specialists in NCAA history, and had the potential to be a lock for a pretty much limitless pro ball career if he bore down and kept his eye on the carrot. The BU punter was 2 years younger than Don Gately. Gately's big digits could barely fit around the iron's easy grip handle, and stooping over the ironing board made the small of his back ache, and he hadn't eaten anything except deep-fried stuff out of shiny plastic packaging for like a week, and the stink of the plastic laminates under the iron stunk wicked bad, and his big square face sagged lower and lower as he stared at the punter's ghostly digital image, until he found himself starting to cry like a babe. It came out of emotional nowheres all of a sudden, and he found himself blubbering at the loss of organized ball, his one gift and other love, his own stupidity and lack of discipline, that blasted cock-sucking Ethan Frum, his mom's cirrhosis and vegetabilization, and his failure after 4 years ever yet to visit, feeling suddenly lower than bottom feeder shit, standing over hot laminates and Polaroid squares and little stick-on DMV letters for rich blonde male boys in the blazing winter light, blubbering amid fraudulent stink and tear steam. It was 2 days later he got pinched for assaulting one bouncer with the unconscious body of another bouncer in Danvers, Massachusetts, and 3 months after that, that he went to Billerica Minimum. Entrepot-bound, twitchy-eyed and checking both sides behind him as he comes, rounding the curve of sub-dormitory B's hall with his stick and little, solid, frustum-shaped stool, Michael Pemulis sees at least 8 panels of the drop ceiling have somehow fallen out of their aluminum struts and are on the floor, some broken in that incomplete, hingy way stuff with fabric content gets broken, including the relevant panel. No old sneaker is in evidence on the floor as he clears the panels to plant the stool, his incredibly potent Bentley Phelps penlight in his teeth, looking up into the darkness of the strut's lattice. Given the Faxter's historical proclivity for fraudulent scams, it was amazing to Gately that he didn't ever know how Fackelman had been fraudulently getting over on Whitey Sorkin in all kinds of little ways almost from the start, and didn't even find out until the not-at-all-small scam with 80s Bill and 60s Bob, which took place during the 3 months Gately was out on bail Sorkin had generously put up. By this time, Gately had fallen in with two lesbian pharmaceutical cocaine addicts he'd met at the gym, doing upside-down sit-ups from the chin-up bar. The lesbians, not Gately, who was strictly from bench, curl, and squat. These vigorous girls ran a rather intriguing house-cleaning and key-copying and burglary operation in Peabody and Wakefield, and Gately had begun working heavy merchandise lifting and 4x4 vehicle promotion for them, serious full-time burglary, as his taste for even the threat of violence diminished on account of remorse at the bouncer damage he'd inflicted in that Danvers bar, after just 7 Heffenreffers and an innocent comment about the BSHS's Minutemen's inferiority to the Danvers HS Rough Riders. And Gately left more and more of Sorkin's transfer and collection work to Fackelman, who, by this time, had gotten back into oral narcotics out of virus fears and stopped resisting the sugar cravings he associated with oral narcs, and gotten so fat and soft his shirt front looked like an accordion when he sat down to eat peanut M&Ms and nod. And now also to a bad news new guy Sorkin had lately befriended and put to work. A fuchsia-haired Harvard Square punk-type kid with a build like a stump and round, black, unblinking eyes. An old-fashioned street-junk needle jockey that went by the moniker Bobby C. Or just C. And liked to hurt people. The only IV heroin addict Gately'd come across that actually preferred violence. With no lips at all, and purple hair and 3 great towering spikes, and little bare patches in the hair on his forearms, from constantly testing the edge on his boot knife, and a leather jacket with way more zippers than anybody could ever need, and a pre-electric earring that hung way down and was a roaring skull in gold plate flames. Gene Fackelman had, it turns out, for years been getting fraudulently over on Whitey Sorkin's bookmaking operation in all sorts of little ways that Gately and Kite, according to Kite, hadn't known about. Usually it was something like Fax taking long-shot action from marginal bettors not well known to Sorkin, and not phoning the action in to Sorkin's secretary, and then, when the long shot lost, collecting the skeet plus vig from the bettor and rat-holing it all for himself.
372.
It had seemed to Gately, after he found out about it, a suicidal-type risk, since if any of these long shots ever actually won, Fackelman would be responsible for giving the bettor his winnings from Whitey, meaning it would be Sorkin that would hear the complaint if Fackelman didn't come up with the money on his own and get it to the bettor. And the whole crew's pharmacological expenses meant they always existed on the absolutist margins of liquidity. At least that's what Gately and Kite, according to Kite, had always thought. It wasn't until Fackelman's map had been presumably eliminated for keeps, and Kite had returned from his long hiatus, and Gately and Kite were getting the late Fackelman stuff together to divvy up valuables and dump the rest, and Gately found, taped to the underside of Fackelman's porn cartridge storage case, over $22,000 in mint crisp ONAN currency. Not until then that Gately realized that Fackelman had, through iron will, kept unspent an emergency reserve skeet payment stake for just such a worst-case possibility. Gately split this found Fackelman money with Trent Kite then, but went and turned his half of it into Sorkin, claiming it was all they'd found. It wasn't that he forked his half over to Sorkin out of any kind of fear. Sorkin would have, regretfully, had the Sea Kid and his nook-fag crew demap him, Gately, too, along with Fackelman, if he'd thought Gately had been part of Fax's scam. But out of guilt over having been clueless about his own fellow Twin Tower screwing Sorkin, after Sorkin had been so neurasthenically overgenerous to them both, and because Fackelman's betrayal had ended up so hurting Sorkin and causing him so much psychosomatic grief that he'd spent a whole week in bed in Saugus, in the dark, with Lone Ranger-type sleep shades on, drinking VO and Kaffergott, and clutching his traumatized cranium and face, feeling betrayed and abandoned, he'd said, his whole faith in the human creature shaken, he'd wept to Gately over the cellular phone, after it all came out. Ultimately, Gately gave Sorkin his half of Fackelman's secret money, mostly to try and cheer Sorkin up. Let him know somebody cared. He also did it for Fackelman's memory, which he was mourning Fax's gruesome death, even at the same time he cursed him for a liar and a rat punk. It was a time of moral confusion for Don G., and his half of the post-mortem money seemed like the best he could do, in terms of like a gesture. He didn't rat out that Kite had a whole other half, which Kite spent his half of the money on Grateful Dead bootlegs and a portable semiconductor refrigeration unit for his DEC 2100's motherboard that upped his processing capacity to 32 megabytes squared of RAM, roughly the same as an interlaced disseminator substation or a New England Bell cellular switch net, though it wasn't 2 months before he'd pawned the DEC and put it in his arm, and had become such a steeply downhill-typed allotted addict that when he signed on as Gately's new trusted associate for B&E's after Gately got out of Billerica, the once mighty Kite wasn't even able to dicky an alarm or shunt a meter, and Gately found himself the brains of the team, which, it was a mark of his own high-angle decline, that this fact didn't make him more nervous. The RN that had flushed his colon while Gately wept with shame is now back in the room with an MD Gately hasn't seen before. He lies there, pinwheel-eyed from pain and efforts to abide via memory. One eye has some sort of blurry sleep goo film in it that won't blink or rub away. The room is filled with mournful, gunmetal, winter PM light. The MD and gorgeous RN are doing something to the room's other bed, attaching something metally complex from out of a big case, not unlike a good table silverware case, with molded purple velvet insides, for metal rods and two half circles of steel. The intercom dings. The MD's got a beeper at his belt, an object with still more unhealthy associations. Gately hasn't exactly been asleep. The heat of his post-op fever makes his face feel tight, like standing too close to a fire. His right side settled down to a sick ache, like a kicked groin. Fackelman's favorite phrase had been, "That's a goddamn lie." He'd used it in response to just about everything. His mustache always looked like it was getting ready to crawl off his lip, Gately's always despised facial hair. The former naval MP had had a great big yellow-gray mustache. He waxed into two sharp, protruding steer horns. The MP was vain about his mustache and spent giant amounts of time clipping and grooming and waxing it. When the MP passed out, Gately used to come, quietly, up and gently push the stiff waxed sides of the mustache into crazy canted angles. Sorkin's new third field operative, Seed, had claimed to collect ears and to have a collection of ears. Bobby C., with his lightless eyes and flat lipless head, like a reptile. The MD was one of those apprentice residential MDs that looked about 12, scrubbed and groomed to a dull pink shine. He radiated the bustling cheer they teach MDs how to radiate at you. He had a child's haircut, complete with spit curl, and his thin neck swam in the collar of his white MD coat, and his coat's pen's pocket protector and the owlish glasses he kept pushing up, together with the little neck, gave Gately the sudden insight that most MDs and ADAs and PD/POs and shrinks, the fearsomest authority figures in a drug addict's life, that these guys came from the pencil-necked ranks of the same weak-chinned weenie kids that drug addicts used to despise and revile and bully as kids. The RN was so attractive in the gray light and goop blur, it was almost grotesque. Her tits were such that she had a little cleft of cleavage showing, even over her RN's uniform, which was not like a low neckline thing. The milky cleavage that suggests tits like two smooth scoops of vanilla ice cream, that your healthy-type girls all have probably got. Gately's forced to confront the fact that he's never once been with a really healthy girl, and not with even so much as a girl of any kind in sobriety. And then, when she reaches way up to unscrew a bolt and some kind of steelish plate on the wall over the empty bed, the, like, hemline of her uniform retreats up north so that the white stocking's rich, violinish curves at the top of the insides of her legs in the white lisle are visible in backlit silhouette, and an embrasure of sad window light shines through her legs. The raw, healthy sexuality of the whole thing just about makes Gately sick with longing and self-pity, and he wants to avert his head. The young M.D. is also staring at the lissome stretch and retreating hem, not even pretending to help with the bolt, missing as he goes to push up the glasses so that he stabs himself in the forehead. The M.D. and R.N. exchange several pieces of real technical medical language. The M.D. drops his clipboard twice. The R.N. either doesn't notice any of the sexual tension in the room because she spent her whole life as the eye of a storm of sexual tension, or else she just pretends not to notice. Gately's almost positive the M.D.'s jacked off before to the thought of this R.N., and he feels sick that he totally empathizes with the M.D. It'd be circumambient sexual tension, would be the ghost word. Gately'd never even let an unhealthy, strung-out type female go into the head for at least an hour after he'd taken a dump in there out of embarrassment. And now, this sickening, circumambient creature had, with her own fleet syringe and soft hands, summoned a loose, pathetic dump from the anus of Bimming Gately, which anus she had thus seen close up, producing a dump. It doesn't even register on Gately that it's spitting a little goopy sleet outside, until he's made himself avert his head from the window and RN. The ceiling's throbbing a little, like a dog when it's hot. The RN had told him from behind her name was Kathy with a C or Kathy with a K, but Gately wants to think of her as just the RN. He can smell himself. A smell like sandwich meat left in the sun, and feel greasy sweat purling all over his scalp, and his unshaved chin against his throat, and the tube taped into his mouth is tacky with the scum of sleep. The thin pillow is hot, and he has no way to flip it over to the cool side of the pillow. It's like his shoulder's grown its own testicles, and every time his heart beats, some very small guy kicked him in them. The testicles. The M.D. sees Gately's open eyes and tells the nurse the gunshot patient is semi-conscious again. And is he cued for any kind of PM med? The sleet fall is slight. It sounds like somebody's throwing little fistfuls of sand at the window from real far away. The deadly RN, helping the MD clamp some kind of weird steel back brace-ish thing with what looks like a metal halo they'd put together from parts out of the big case, clamping the thing to the head of the bed and to little steel plates under the bed's heart monitor. It looks sort of like the upper part of an electric chair, he thinks. The RN looks down in mid-stretch and says, "Hi, Mr. Gately." And says Mr. Gately is allergic and doesn't get any meds except antipyretics and Toradol in a drip, Dr. Pressburger. "Do you, Mr. Gately, you poor, brave, allergic thing?" Her voice is like, you can just imagine what she'd sound like getting X'd and really liking it. Gately's repelled at himself for having taken a dump in front of this kind of RN. The MD's name had sounded just like Pressburger, or Prissburger, and Gately's now sure the poor yutz had taken daily ass-kickings from sinister future drug addicts as a kid. The MD's perspiring in the ambient sexuality of the RN. He says, the MD does, "So what's he intubated for, if he's conscious and self-ventilating and on a drip?" This is while the MD's trying to screw the metal halo itself to the top of the back brace-ish thing with bolt-head screws, one knee up on the bed and stretching, so part of the red, soft upper part of his ass is showing over his belt, not being able to get the thing screwed on, shaking the metal halo, like it's stubborn fault. And even lying there, Gately can tell the guy's turning the bolt head screws the wrong way. The RN comes over and puts a cool, soft hand on Gately's forehead, in a way that makes the forehead want to die with shame. What Gately can get from what she says to Dr. Pressburger is that there'd been concern that Gately might have got a fragment of whatever projectile he got invaded with in, through, or near his lower something trachea, since there'd been trauma to his something with six syllables that started with sterno. She said the radiology results were indefinite but suspicious. And somebody called Pendleton had wanted a 16-millimeter siphuncular nebulizer dispensing 4 milliliters of 20% mucomist
373
every 2 hours, on the off chance of hemorrhage or mucoidal flux, like just in case. The parts of this Gately can follow he doesn't care for one bit. He doesn't want to know his body even fucking has something with six syllables in it. The horrifying RN wipes Gately's face off as best she can with her hand and says she'll try to fit him in for a sponge bath before she goes off shift at 1600 hours, at which Gately goes rigid with dread. The RN's hand smells of Kiss My Face brand organic hand and body lotion, which Pant Modicean also uses. She tells the poor MD to let her have a try at the cranial brace. Those things are always a bear to screw in. Her shoes are those sub-audible nurse's shoes that make no sound, so it seems like she glides away from Gately's bed instead of walks away. Her legs aren't visible until she gets a certain ways away. The MD's own shoes have a wet squeak to the left one. The MD looks like he hasn't slept well in about a year. There's a faint vibe of prescription dreams about the guy, on Gately's view. He paces squeakily at the foot of the bed, watching the RN turn the screws the right way, and pushes his owlish glasses up and says that Clifford Pendleton, scratch golfer or no, is a post-traumatic maroon. That nebulized mucomist is for, and here his voice makes it clear he's reciting from memory, like to show off, abnormal, viscid, or inspissated post-traumatic mucus, not potential hemorrhaging or edema, and that 16-millimeter siphuncular intubation itself had been specifically discredited as intratracheal edema prophylaxis in the second-to-last issue of Morbid Trauma Quarterly, as so diametrically invasive that it was more apt to exacerbate than to alleviate hemoptysis, according to somebody he calls Laird or Layered. Gately's listening in with the uncomprehending close attention of, like, a child whose parents are discussing something adultly complex about childcare in its presence. The condescension with which Prisberger inserts that hemoptysis means something called pertussive hemorrhage, like Kathy the RN wasn't enough of a pro not to have to insert little technical explanations for, makes Gately sad for the guy. It's obvious the guy, pathetically, thinks this kind of limp, condescending shit will impress her. Gately's got to admit he would have tried to impress her too, though, if she hadn't met him by holding a kidney-shaped pan under his working anus. The RN's finishing packing up the parts of the brace thing the MD couldn't seem to attach, meanwhile. She was saying the MD seemed awfully well up on methodology for something called a 2R, as they left. And Gately could tell, the MD couldn't tell, she was being a little sarcastic. The MD was struggling to try to carry the thing's case, which Gately judges weighs, at most, 30 kilograms. It occurs to him, head-on for the first time, that the real reason Stavros L. hired shelter-cleaning guys out of halfway houses was that he could get away with paying them like bupkis, and that he, Don G., must surely, on some level, have known this all along, but been in some kind of denial about confronting it head-on, that he was getting fucked over by Stavros the Shoe Freak, and that the word embrasure had been surely another invasive wraith ghost word, and then now also that nobody seems to exactly be falling all over themselves to bring the paper and pen it had sure seemed like Joel Van D. had understood Gately's mimed request for, and that thus, maybe, Joel's visit and show-and-tell with the snapshots had been just as much a febrile hallucination as the figuranted wraith, and that it has stopped spitting sleet, but the clouds out there still look like they mean serious business, out there, over Brighton Alston, and that if Joelle VD's intimate visit with the photo album was a hallucination, that at least meant it was also a hallucination she was wearing fucking college kid Ken or Daddy sweatpants, and that the low-angled sadness of the cloudy PM light meant it had to be pretty near 1600 hours, EST. So that maybe, there by the grace, he could avoid, maybe, getting an uncontrolled Woody, getting sponged, naked, by the horrifyingly attractive Kathy with a K or a C. But still, could get sponged by her linebacker of a replacement, because the sour, meaty smell of himself was grim. Only maybe miss the Woody hazard and get sponged by the big, hairy mold, 1600 to 2400 hour nurse in support hose to who Gately's anus was a stranger. Plus, that 1600 hours EST was spontaneous dissemination time for Mr. Bouncity Bounce, the mentally ill kitty show host Gately's always loved, and used to try his best with Kite and poor old Fackleman to be home and largely alert for, and that nobody's once offered to click on the HD viewer that hangs next to a myopic, fake Turner fog and boat print on the wall opposite Gately's and the former kid's beds, and that he had no remote with which to either activate the TP at 1600 or ask somebody else to activate it. That without some kind of notebook and pencil, he couldn't communicate even the basicest question or, like, concept to anybody. It was like he was a vegetated, hemorrhagic stroke victim. Without a pencil and notebook, he couldn't even seem to get across a request for a notebook and pencil. It was like he was trapped inside his huge, chattering head. Unless, his head then points out, Joelle Van Dyne's visit had been real, and her understanding of the pen and notebook gesture had been real. But somebody out there in the hallway with a hat, or at the hospital president's office, or at the nurse's station with his interdicted M. Hanley brownies, and also interdicted the request for writing supplies, at the finest's request, so he couldn't get his story straight with anybody before they came for him. That it was like a pre-interrogation softening up thing. They were leaving him trapped in himself. A figurant, mute and unmoving and blank, like the house's catatonic lady, slumped, moist and pale in her chair. Or the advanced basics group's adopted girl's vegetable kingdom sister. Or the whole catatonic gang over at EMPHH's number 5 shed, silent and dead-faced, even when touching a tree or propped up amid exploding front lawn firecrackers. Or the Wraith's non-existent kid. It's got to be past 1600 hours, light-wise, unless it's the lowering clouds. There's roughly 0% or less visibility now outside the sleet-crusted window. The room's window light is darkening to that kaopectate shade that has always marked the just pre-sunset time of day that Gately, like most drug addicts, has always most dreaded, and had always either lowered his helmet and charged extra murderous at somebody to block it out, the late-day dread, or else dropped Quo Vadis or oral narcotics or turned on Mr. Bouncity Bounce extra loud, or busied himself in his silly chef's hat in the in-and-house kitchen, or made sure he was at a meeting sitting way up close in nose-pore range to block it out, the late-day dread. The gray light, late-afternoon dread, always worse in winter, the dread, in winter's watered-down light. Just like the secret dread he's always felt whenever everybody happened to ever leave the room and left him alone in a room, a terrible, stomach-sinking dread that probably dates all the way back to being alone in his extra-extra-large Denton's and crib below Herman the ceiling that breathed. It occurs to Gately that right now's just like when he was a toddler, and his mom and her companion were both passed out or worse. No matter how frightened or scared he might become, he now again cannot get anybody to come, or to hear, or even know about it. The discredited tube to prevent vicious or inspired bleeding in his suspicious trachea has left him completely alone. Worse off than a toddler that could at least bellow and yowl, rattling the bars of its playpen in terror that nobody tall was in any shape to hear him. Plus, this dreadful time of weak, gray, late day light is the time, was the time, when the sad and nerdily dressed wraith appeared yesterday. Assuming that was yesterday. Assuming it was a real wraith. But the wraith, with its chinky coke and theories of post-mortem speed, had been able to interface with Gately without aid of speech or gesture or Bic, was why, even out of his mind, Gately had had to admit to himself it must have been a delusion, a fever dream. But he has to admit he'd kind of liked it, the dialogue, the give and take, the way the wraith could seem to get inside him, the way he said Gately's best thoughts were really communiques from the patient and abiding dead. Gately wonders if his organic father, the ironworker, is not now maybe dead and dropping in and standing very still from time to time for a communique. He felt slightly better. The room's ceiling was not breathing. It lay flat as a stucco sheet, rippling only slightly with the petroleum fumes of fever and Gately's own smell. Then, bubbling up out of nowhere again, he suddenly confronts deep, focused memories of Jean Fackelman's final demise, and Gately and Pamela Hoffman Jeep's involvement in Fackelman's demise. Gately, for several months before he did his state assault bid, was disastrously involved with one Pamela Hoffman Jeep, his first girl ever with a hyphen, a sort of upscale but directionless and not very healthy and pale and incredibly passive Danvers girl that worked in purchasing for a hospital supply company in Swampscott, and was pretty definitely an alcoholic, and drank bright drinks with umbrellas in Route 1 clubs in the late PM, until she swooned and passed out with a loud clunk. That's what she called it, swooned. The swooning, and passing out with a loud clunk, as her head hit the table, was more or less a nightly thing, and Pamela Hoffman Jeep fell automatically in love with any man she termed chivalrous.
374.
Enough to carry her out to the parking lot and drive her home without raping her, which rape of an unconscious, head-lolling girl she termed taking advantage. Gately got introduced to her by Fackelman, who, one time, as he came up through a sports bar called the Poor Houses parking lot to dialogue with a Sorkin debtor, Gately saw Fackelman staggering along carrying this unconscious girl to his ride, one big hand quite a bit farther up her prom-looking taffeta gown than it really needed to be to carry her. And Fackelman told Gately, if Don'd give this gash a ride home, he'd stay and do the collection, which Gately's heart wasn't in collections anymore, and he jumped at the trade. As long as Fackelman could promise him, she could hold her various fluids in the 4x4 he was driving. So it was Fackelman who told him, as he put the tiny and limp but still continent body in his arms in the parking lot of the poorhouse, to watch his personal six, Gately, and be sure and violate her a little, because this gash here was like one of those South Sea culture gashes, in that if Gately took her home and she woke up non-violated, she'd be Gately's for life. But Gately obviously had no intention of raping an unconscious person, much less even putting his hand up the gown of a girl that might lose her fluids any second, and this locked him in to the involvement. Pamela Hoffman Jeep called Gately her knight errand and fell passively in love with his refusal to take advantage. Jean Fackelman, she confided, was not the gentleman Gately was. What helped make the involvement disastrous was that Pamela Hoffman Jeep was always either so leglessly drunk or so passively hungover all the time that any sort of sex, any time at all with her, would have classified as taking advantage. This girl was the single, passivist person Gately ever met. He never once saw PHJ actually get from one spot to another under her own power. She needed somebody chivalrous to pick her up and carry her and lay her back down 24/7/365, it seemed like. She was a sort of sexual papoose, She spent most of her life passed out and sleeping. She was a beautiful sleeper, kittenish and serene, never drooling. She made passivity and unconsciousness look kind of beautiful. Falkeman called her Death's poster child. Even at work at the hospital supply company, Gately imagined her horizontal, curled fetal on something soft, with all the hot, slack facial intensity of a sleeping baby. He imagined her bosses and co-workers all tiptoeing around, purchasing, whispering to each other to not wake her up. She never once rode in the actual front seat of any vehicle he drove her home in. But she also never threw up or pissed herself or even complained, just smiled and yawned an infant's little milky yawn and snuggled deeper into whatever Gately had swaddled her in. Gately started doing that thing about yelling, "They'd been robbed!" when he carried her into whatever stripped luxury apartment they were crewing in. PHJ wasn't what you'd call great-looking, but she was incredibly sexy, Gately felt, because she always managed to look like you just exed her into a state of total, unmuscled swoon, lying there unconscious. Trent Kite told Fackelman he thought Gately was out of his fucking mind. Fax observed that Kite himself was not exactly a W.T. Sherman with the ladies, even with coke whores and strung-out nursing students and dipsoid lounge hags whose painted faces swung loose from their heads. Falkelman claimed to have started a log just to keep track of Kite's attempted pickup lines, surefire lines, like, for example, "You're the second most beautiful woman I've ever seen. The first most beautiful woman I've ever seen being former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. And if you came home with me, I'm unusually confident that I could achieve an erection." And said that if Kite wasn't still cherry at 23 and a half, it was proof of some kind of divine-type grace. Sometimes Gately would come out of a Demerol nod and look at pale, passive Pamela, lying there sleeping beautifully, and undergo a time-lapse clairvoyant thing, where he could almost visibly watch her losing her looks through her 20s. And her face starting to slide over off her skull onto the pillow she held like a stuffed toy, becoming a lounge hag right before his eyes. The vision aroused more compassion than horror, which Gately never even considered might qualify him as a decent person. Gately's two favorite things about Pamela Hoffman Jeep were the way she would come out of her stupor and hold her cheek and laugh hysterically each time Gately carried her across the threshold of some stripped apartment and bellow that they'd been ripped off, and the way she always wore the long white linen gloves and bare-shoulder taffeta that made her seem like some upscale North Shore debutante who's had, like, one too many dippers of country club punch and is just begging to be taken advantage of by some low-rent guy with a tattoo. She'd make a sort of languid, very slow-motion, bullwhip gesture with her hand in the long white glove as she lay wherever Gately had deposited her, and simper out with an upscale inflection, "Don, honey, bring Mommy a highball." She called a drink a highball, which it turned out was a deadly impression of her own mom, who, it turned out, this lady made Gately's own mom look like Carrie Nation by comparison, blush-wise. The only four times Gately ever met Mrs. H.J. were all at ERs and sanitaria. Gately lies there, pop-eyed with guilt and anxiety, in the hiss and click of resumed sleet, in the twilit St. E.'s room, next to the glittering back brace and skull halo thing, clamped exoskeletally to the empty next bed, and gleaming dully at selected welds. Gately trying to abide, remembering. It had been Pamela Hoffman Jeep that finally clued Gately in on the little ways Gene Fackelman had been historically getting over on Whitey Sorkin, and alerted him to the suicidal creek Fackelman had gotten himself into, with a certain mistaken bet scam that had blown up right in his map. Even Gately had been able to tell something was the matter. For the last 2 weeks, Fackelman had been squatting sweatily in a corner of the stripped living room, right outside the little luxury bedroom Gately and Pamela were lying in, out there, squatting, over a sterno cooker, an incredible twin hills of sky blue dilaudid and many-hued M&Ms, not much speaking or responding or moving or even seeming to cop and nod, just sitting there, hunched and plump and glistening like some sort of cornered toad, his mustache flailing around on his lip. Things would have had to be bad indeed for Gately ever to try to get coherent data out of PHJ. Apparently, the deal was that one of the bettors that bet with Sorkin through Fackelman was a guy Gately and Fackelman know only as 80s Bill, an impeccably groomed guy that wore red suspenders under snazzy Zegna brand menswear and tortoiseshell specs and docksiders, an old-fashioned corporate takeoverer, an asset plunderer, maybe 50, with an exchange place office and a souvenir Free Milkin' bumper sticker on his Beamer. It was a night of many highballs and much papoosing, and Gately had to keep flicking the top of PHJ's skull to keep her conscious long enough to free associate her way through the details. Who was on his fourth marriage to his third aerobics instructor, and who liked to bet only on Ivy League college hoops. But who, when he did so, bet amounts so huge that Fackelman always had to get Sorkin's pre-approval on the bet, and then call 80s Bill back, and so on. But so, according to Pamela Hoffman Jeep, this 80s Bill, who's a Yale alum and usually unabashedly sentimental about what Pamela H.J. laughingly says Fackelman called his alma mater. Well, on this particular time, it seems like a little impeccably groomed birdie has whispered in 80s Bill's hairy ear, because this one time 80s Bill wants to put $125K down on Brown U against Yale U, that is, betting against his alma mater. Only he wants minus 2 points instead of the even spread. Sorkin and the rest of the Boston books are taking off the Atlantic City line for a spread. And Fackelman has the cell phone down to Saugus to bounce this off Sorkin, except Sorkin's down in the city in Enfield at the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation office, getting his weekly UV bombardment and Kaffergott refill from Dr. Robert 60s Bob Monroe, the septuagenarian pink sunglasses and Nehru jacket-wearing NCFPF, ergotic vascular headache treatment specialized, a guy who, in your days, interned at Sandoz and was one of T. Leary's original circle of mayonnaise jar acid droppers at T. Leary's now legendary house in West Newton, Massachusetts, and is now, 60s Bob, an intimate acquaintance of Kite, because 60s Bob is an even bigger Grateful Dead fanatic, maybe even than Kite, and sometimes got together with Kite and several other dead devotees, most of who now had canes and O2 tanks, and traded historical souvenir-type tiger's eyes and paisley doublets and tie-dyes and lava lamps and bandanas and plasma spheres and variegated black light posters of involuted geometric designs, and argued about which dead shows and bootlegs of dead shows were the greatest of all time in different regards, and just basically had a hell of a time. 60s Bob, an inveterate collector and haggling trader of shit, sometimes took Kite along on little expeditions of eclectic and seedy shops for dead-related paraphernalia, sometimes even informally fencing stuff for Kite, and so, indirectly, Gately, covering Kite with money when Kite's rigid need schedule didn't permit a more formal and time-consuming fence. 60s Bob then trading the merchandise around various seedy locales for 60s-related shit nobody else would even usually want. A couple times Gately had to actually finger an ice cube out of a highball and slip it under the shoulderless neckline of PHJ's prom gown to try to keep her on some kind of track. Like most incredibly passive people, the girl had a terrible time ever separating details from what was really important to a story. It's why she rarely ever got asked anything. But, so, the point is that the person that took Fackelman's call about 80s Bill's mammoth Yale Brown bet wasn't, in fact, Sorkin, but rather Sorkin's secretary, one Gwendine O'Shea, the howitzer-breasted, old, green-cardless former IRA moll who'd gotten hit on the head with a truncheon by a godless Belfast bobby once too often back on the old sod, And whose skull now was, in Fackelman's own terminology, soft as puppy shit in the rain. But who had just the seedy sort of distracted, grandmotherly air that makes her perfect for clapping her red-knuckled old hands to her cheeks and squealing as she claimed mass lottery winnings whenever Whitey Sorkin and his M.A. Statehouse bagman cronies arranged to have a Sorkinite buy a mysteriously winning mass lottery ticket from one of the countless convenience stores Sorkin and cronies own through dummy corporations all up and down the North Shore, and who, because she could not only give what Sorkin claimed was the only adequate cervical massage west of the burned Hot Alp Springs Center, but also could both word process a shocking 110 words per minute and wield a shillelagh like nobody's business, plus had been W. Sorkin's dear late IRA mall mum's Scrabble pal back in Belfast on the old sod, served as Whitey's chief administrative aide, manning the cellular phones when Sorkin was out or indisposed. And so, but PHJ's point, which Gately has to just about crack her scalp open, flicking out of her, Gwendine O'Shea, familiar with 80s Bill and his YU Bulldog sentimentality, plus cranially soft as a fucking grape, O'Shea took Fackelman's call wrong. Thought Fackelman said 80s Bill wanted 125K with minus 2 points on Yale instead of minus 2 on Brown. Put Fackelman on hold and made him listen to Irish Muzak while she put in a call to a Yale athletic department mole out of Sorkin's read-protected databases mole file, and learned that the Yale U Bulldog star power forward had been diagnosed with an extremely rare neurologic disorder called postcoital vestibulitis.
375.
In which, for several hours after intercourse, the power forward tended to suffer such a terrible, vertiginous loss of proprioception that he literally couldn't tell his ass from his elbow, much less make an authoritative move to the bucket. Plus then O'Shea's second call to Sorkin's Brown U athletic mole, a locker room attendant everybody thinks is deaf, reveals that several of Brown U's most sirenish and school-spirited hetero co-eds had been recruited, auditioned, briefed, rehearsed, that is, debriefed, giggles Pamela Hoffman-Jeep, whose giggles involve the sort of ticklish, shoulder-writhing undulations of a much younger girl getting tickled by an authority figure and pretending not to like it, and stationed at strategic points, I-95 rest stops, in the spare tire compartment at the rear of the Bulldog's chartered bus, in the evergreen shrubbery outside the team's special entrance to the Pizzatola Athletic Center in Providence, in concave recesses along the Pizzatola tunnels between special entrance and visitor's locker room, even in a specially enlarged and sensually appointed locker next to the power forward's locker in the VLR, all prepared, like the Brown cheerleaders and pep squad who've been induced to do the game pantyless, electrolyzed, and splits-prone, to help lend a pyrotechnic, glandular atmosphere to the power forward's whole playing environment, prepared to make the penultimate sacrifice for squad, school, and influential members of the Brown Alumni Bruins Boosters Association, so that Gwendine O'Shea then switches back to Fackelman and okays the mammoth bet and point spread, as like, who wouldn't, with that kind of mole-reported fix in the works. Except, of course, she's taken the wager backwards. That is, O'Shea thinks 80s Bill's now got 125K on Yale coming within 2 points, while 80s Bill, who it turns out cast himself as White Knight in bidding for majority control of Providence's Federated Funnel and Cone Corporation, ONAN's leading manufacturer of conoid receptacles with FF&C, CEO'd by a prominent Brown alumnus so rabid a Bruins booster, he actually wears a snarling, hollow bear head to conference games, whose ass 80s Bill is going about kissing like nobody's beeswax, PHJ inserts, hinting it was 80s Bill who tipped the Bruins staff off about the power forward's Achilles' vas deferens. EB quite reasonably believes he's now got Brown within a deuce for 125 El Grandes. The wrench in the ointment that nobody in Providence has counted on is the picket and knuckle-duster-wielding appearance of Brown University's entire Dworkinite female objectification prevention and protest phalanx. Outside the Pizzatola Athletic Center's main gates, right at game time, two FOPPPs per motorcycle who blow through the filigreed gates like they were so much wet Kleenex and storm the arena, plus a division of Brown's pluckier undergraduate NOWs who execute a pincer movement down from the cheap seats up top during the first timeout. At the precise moment, the Brown cheerleaders' first pyramid maneuver ends in a midair split that causes the Pizzatola's scoreboard scorekeeper to reel backward against his controls and blow out both homes and visitors' zeros on the scoreboard, just as the FOPPP's unmuffled hogs come blatting, malevolently, down through the ground-level tunnels and out onto the playing floor. And in the ensuing melee, not only are cheerleaders, pep squad, and comely Brown U sirens all either laid out with picket signs, wielded like shillelaghs, or thrown kicking and shrieking over the burly shoulders of militant FOPPPs and carried off on roaring hogs, leaving the Yale power forward's delicate nervous system intact, if overheated. But two Brown U Bruin starters, a center and a shooting guard, both too wrung out and dazed by a grueling week of comely siren auditioning and rehearsing to have sense enough to run like hell once the melee spills out onto the Pizzatola hardwood, are felled by an FOPPP knuckle-duster and a disoriented referee with a martial arts background, respectively. And so, when the floor is finally cleared, and stretchers borne off and the game resumes, Yale U cleans Brown U's clock by upwards of 20. Then so Falkeman calls up 80's Bill and arranges to pick up the skeet, which is $137,500 with the VIG, which EB gives him in large denomination pre-ONAN script in a Go Brown Bruins gym bag he'd brought to the game to sit next to the Ursine-headed CEO with, and now has less than no use for. But so Fackelman receives the skeet downtown and blasts up cheesy Route 1 to Saugus to deliver the skeet and pick up his VIG on the VIG, $625 U.S., right away, needing to cop blues in what's starting to be the worst way, etc. Plus Fackelman's figuring on maybe a small bonus, or at least some emotional validation from Sorkin, for bringing in such a mammoth and promptly remitted wager. But when he gets to the Route 1 titty bar, at the rear of which Sorkin has his administrative offices behind an unmarked fire door, and all wallpapered and stuff that looks like ersatz wood paneling, Gwendine O'Shea wordlessly points behind her station at Sorkin's personal office door with a terse gesture Falkeman doesn't think fits with the upbeatness of the occasion at all. The door's got a big poster of Rush Limbaugh on it, from before the assassination. Sorkin's in there working spreadsheets with his special monitor screen light filtering goggles on. The goggles' lenses, on their long protruding barrels, look like lobsters' eyes on stalks. Gately and Falkelman and Bobby C. never spoke to Sorkin until spoken to, not out of henchmanish obsequity, but because they could never tell what Sorkin's craniofacial vascular condition was, or if he could tolerate sound until they verifiably heard him tolerating his own sound. So G. Falkelman waits, wordlessly, to hand over 80's Bill's skeet, standing there tall and soft and palely sweating, the overall shape and color of a peeled boiled egg. When Sorkin hikes an eyebrow at the Go Bruins bag and says the knee-slapping hilarity of the joke escapes him, Falkelman's mustache positively takes off all over his upper lip, and he prepares to say what he always says when he's flummoxed, that whatever's being said is, with all due respect, goddamn lie. Sorkin saves his data and pushes his desk chair back so he can reach all the way down to the fireproof drawer. The goggles are often used in data processing sweatshops and list for a deuce. Sorkin grunts as he hauls out a huge old mass lottery box for quick-pick cards and heaves it onto the desk, where it bulges obscenely, filled with 112.5K U.S. There's 112.5 fucking K in there, all in ones. 125K minus VIG, what Sorkin, via O'Shea, believes to be 80's Bill's winnings, all in small bills, because Sorkin's pissed off and can't resist making a little, like, gesture. Fackelman doesn't say anything. His mustache goes limp as his mental machinery starts revving. Sorkin, massaging his temples, staring up at Fackelman with his goggles like a crab in a tank, says he supposes he can't blame Fax or O'Shea, that he'd have okayed the bet himself, what with the neurologic tip on the Yale forward they had. Who could have foreseen thuggish feminazis screwing up the ointment? He utters a bit of Gaelic that Fackelman doesn't know but assumes to be fatalistical. He peels 6 C-notes and an O-N-A-N-ite 25 spot off a wad the size of an artillery shell and pushes them across the metal desk at Fackelman. He is Vig on the Vig. He says, "What the fuck?" Sorkin does. This 80s Bill kid's irrational sentimentalism for Yale will, sooner or later, catch up with him. Veteran books tend to be statistically philosophical and patient. Fackelman doesn't even bother to wonder why Sorkin refers to 80s Bill as kid when they're both about the same age. But a high-watt bulb is slowly beginning to incandesce over Fackelman's moist head. As in, the Faxter starts to conceptualize the overall concept of what must have happened. He still hasn't said anything, Pamela Hoffman Jeep emphasizes. Sorkin looks Fackelman over and asks if he's gained some asymmetrical type weight there. Fackelman's left tit does look noticeably bigger than his right, under his sport coat, because of the legal envelope with 137 thousands and 1/500 in it, the skeet from an 80s Bill who thought he'd lost, just like Sorkin thought EB'd won. The slight high whine in the room that Sorkin thinks is his Infernitron disk drive is really the whine of Fackelman's high-speed mentation. His mustache rolls like a cracked whip as he works his own internal mental spreadsheet. 250K in one lumpy sum represented like 375 sky blue grams of hydromorphone hydrochloride.
376.
Or like 37,500 10 milligram soluble tablets of the shit, available from a certain rapacious but discreet Chinatown opiate dealer who'd only deal synthetic narcs in 100 gram weights, which all translated, assuming Kite could be persuaded to pack up his DEC 2100 and move far, far away with Fackelman to help him set up a street distribution matrix in some urban market far, far away into close to, like, let's see, carry the one, like 1.9 million in street value, which some meant that Fackelman, and to a lesser junior partner extent Kite, could have their chins on their chests for the rest of their days without ever having to strip another apartment, forge another passport, break another thumb. All if Fackelman just kept his map shut about O'Shea's confabulation of Yale, Brown, Brown, Yale, mumbled something about an IV adulterant causing a sudden and temporary gigantism in one tit, and blasted out of there straight down Route 1 to this one Dr. Wu and Associates, Hong Toi's Cold Tea Emporium, Chinatown. By this time, Pamela Hoffman Jeep had succumbed to the highballs and her own swaddled warmth and was irreversibly swooned, ice or Philip or no, twitching synaptically and murmuring to somebody named Monty that he was certainly no kind of gentleman in her book. But Gately could chart the rest of Fackelman's Shit Creek's course for himself. When approached by Fackelman with a Go Brown gym bag of Dr. Wu's finest wholesale delauded, and invited to decamp with him and set up a distrib matrix for their own drug empire far, far away, Kite would have staggered back in horror at Fackelman's obviously not knowing that the better, 80s Bill, was in fact none other than the son of 60s Bob, namely, Whitey Sorkin's personal migraineologist, who Sorkin trusted and confided in, as only a massive IV dose of Kaffergott can make you trust and confide, and whom Sorkin would, undoubtedly, tell all about the guy's own son's huge win on Yale, and who wasn't, like, Ward and Wally close with his son, 60s Bob wasn't, but naturally kept distant paternal tabs on him, and would certainly have known that E.B.'d in fact bet Brown in an attempt to cozy up to the Connick CEO, and so would know that there'd been some kind of mix-up. And also that Kite'd still be staggering back in horror as all this added up. Plus, even if Sorkin somehow didn't get told of 80s Bill's loss and Fackelman's scam from 60s Bill, the fact was that Sorkin's newest, savagest U.S. muscle, Bobby C.C., old-fashioned smack addict, copped regular old organic Burmese heroin from this Dr. Wu on a regular basis, and was sure to hear about 300-plus grams of wholesale Dilaudid bought by a Fackelman known to be C's co-employee off Sorkin. And thus, that Fackelman, who, when he came to Kite with the proposition, was already in possession of a brown booster bag full of 37,500 10-milligram Dilaudids and minus Sorkin's 250K, plus with, as Gately later knew, only 22K in suicidal scam-back fire insurance capital, was already dead. Fackelman was a dead man, Kite would have said, staggering back with horror at Fax's idiocy. Kite'd have said he could smell Fackelman already biodegrading from here. Dead as a fucking post, he'd have told Fackelman, already worrying about being seen sitting there with him in whatever titty bar they were in when Fax hit Kite with the proposal. And Gately, watching PHJ sleep, could not only imagine but identify, fully, with how Fackelman, on hearing Kite say he could smell him dead and why, with how Fackelman, instead of taking his bag full of blues and gluing on a goatee and immediately fleeing to climes that had never even fucking heard of Metro Boston's North Shore, that the Faxter'd done what any drug addict in possession of his substance would do when faced with fatal news and attendant terror. Fackelman'd made a fucking beeline for their luxury-stripped home and familiar safe-feeling hearth, and had plopped down and immediately fired up the sterno cooker and cooked up and tied off and shot up and nailed his chin to his chest and kept it there with staggering quantities of Dilaudid, trying to mentally blot out the reality of the fact that he was going to get demapped if he didn't take some kind of decisive remedial action at once. Because, Gately realized even then, this was your drug addict's basic way of dealing with problems, was using the good old substance to blot out the problem. Also, probably, medicating his terror by stuffing himself with peanut M&Ms, which would explain all the wrappers littering the floor of the corner he hadn't moved from. That thus, this is why Fackelman had been squatting, moist and silent, in a corner of the living room, right outside this very bedroom here for days. This was why the apparent contradiction of the staggering amount of substance Fackelman had in the gym bag next to him, together with the cornered toad look of a man in the great fear one associates with withdrawal. Charting and thinking, drumming his fingers absently on PHJ's unconscious skull, Gately realized he could more than empathize with Fackelman's flight into Dilaudid and M&Ms. But now he realizes that that was the first time it really ever dawned on him, in force, that a drug addict was, at root, a craven and pathetic creature. A thing that basically hides. The most sexual thing Gately ever did with Pamela Hoffman Jeep was he liked to unwrap her cocoon of blankets and climb in with her and spoon in real tight, fitting his bulk up close against all her soft, concave places, and then go to sleep with his face in her nape. It bothered Gately that he could empathize with Fackelman's desire to hide and blot out. But in the retrospect of memory, now it bothers him more that he didn't lie there, up next to the comatose girl, being bothered for more than a few minutes before he felt the familiar desire that blots out all bother, and that night, he had unwrapped the cocoon of bedding and arisen so automatically in service of this desire. And feels the worst of all that he'd lumbered out of the bedroom, in just jeans and belt, out to the gloaming living room where Fackelman was hunched, moist, and smeary-mouthed, in the corner next to a mountain of 10-milligram Dilaudids, and his mixing bowl of distilled water, and works kit and sterno unit, that Gately had lumbered so automatically out to Fackelman under the pretense, to himself, too, the pretense was the worst thing, the pretense that he was just going to check on poor old Fackelman, to maybe try and convince him to take some kind of action, go penitent to Sorkin, or flee the climb, instead of just hiding there in the corner with his mind in neutral and his chin on his chest, and a stalactite of chocolated drool from his lower lip lengthening. Because he knew that the first thing Fackelman would do when Gately left PHJ and lumbered out to the defurnished living room would be to fumble in his Gore-Tex works kit for a new factory-wrapped syringe and invite Gately to hunker on down and get right with the planet. That is, ingest some of this mountain of the lauded to keep Fackelman company. Which, to Gately's shame, he did, had done, and no part of the reality of Fackelman's Creek and the need for action had even been brought up, so intent were they on the blues, somnolent hum, blotting everything out, while Pamela Hoffman Jeep lay wrapped tight in the other room, dreaming of damsels and towers. Gately did, he remembers vividly, he let Fackelman fix them both up but good, and told himself he was doing it to keep Fackelman company, like sitting up with a sick friend, and, maybe worst, believed it was true. Little entr'acts of feverish dreams punctuate memories and being conscious, like he dreams he's riding due north on a bus, the same color as its own exhaust, passing again and again the same gutted cottages, an expanse of heaving sea, weeping. The dream goes on and on, without any kind of resolution or arrival, and he weeps and sweats as he lies there, stuck in it. Gately comes sharply around when he feels the little rough tongue